This is Social Entrepreneur with Shay and Rand Parton of Apollos.
So there's never this like idea of let's just invest in marketing, let's invest in the hope that Oprah is going to wear it and then all our debt's going to go away.
Welcome to Social Entrepreneur. My name is Tony Lloyd. I'm a former Fortune 500 executive, but today I spend my time with changemakers who are making an impact in the world. Each week, you'll hear exciting stories of ordinary people just like you who are making a difference. They share their successes, their failures, and what they're learning along the way. Thanks for being with me today. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome back to Social Entrepreneur. And today's guest, Shay and Rand Parton of Apollos. Now, Apollos means global citizen. So they are a socially motivated lifestyle brand. I had to ask what that meant, but they're going to tell the story of how they traveled with their parents when they were young, and that really gave them kind of a global view, and how they grew up in Santa Barbara, but they ended up starting their company when they were in their teens in their parents' garage. So here they are to tell the story, Shay and Rand Parton of Apollos.
My name is Shay. I'm the CEO of Apollos.
My name is Ran, and I am the creative director of Apollos.
And what is Apollos then?
Apollos means global citizen. We're a socially motivated lifestyle brand. I can kind of build on that if that's helpful, Tony, or if you want something.
Yeah, you know, I hear that phrase lifestyle brand used a lot. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the key for us is the idea of that proverb teaching someone how to fish rather than giving them fish. And then what we learned from quite a bit of traveling is that there's plenty of well-trained fishermen. They often don't have the right bait or a large enough pond in these third world economies. So we saw an opportunity to co-design products with communities and cooperatives to bring them to a wider audience and a stronger market, and really anchoring it to this word Apollos, which translates to global citizen. So we believe all people are created equal and should have equal access to the global market. And the lifestyle component to it is just trying to make everyday products that last for a long time.
All right. So you're thinking about these craftsmen, these craftspeople around the world who produce some cool stuff, but they don't really have access to markets. Is that who you're working with then?
Yeah. I mean, that's a chunk of our business. And the other, we have like two buckets. One is to empower global citizens, and that's with this third world artisan supply chain. And the other is to equip global citizens with product that's travel-minded, well-designed, everything that's B Corp certified for both of those buckets. We've just decided that you shouldn't buy a jacket that you wear to dinner and then a jacket you wear to travel. There should be fewer, better products in our life. Rand does all the design. I do the business. And so we wanted to, the blazer that I'm wearing is a quilted blazer, and it's a great item that I wear out with my wife to dinner. And then it's a great pillow that I can sleep on when I'm traveling and doesn't wrinkle, so I can wear it to the first meeting after a red eye.
When people purchase things, it seems more and more they're trying to use those purchases to do social good in the world. They're trying to use their dollars to affect change. Is that a trend you see? Is that still true? Is it a trend that's fading or waning, or is it still strong, or how do you think about that?
You know, I think as the market really sort of dictates the transparency and ethics of production and product creation, I think it's not so much as a part of the exchange or part of the transaction, but it's actually kind of an expectation overnight. In the same way we go to a restaurant that, you know, there's a chef-run restaurant in the culinary industry or different agriculture groups. You know, there's not like the transaction or the premeditated decision to go there doesn't hinge on the organic produce or the kind of ethics of the farm that they worked out of, but it's kind of like an overnight expectation that they would know what they're doing. So I think that's kind of what's happening in our business, is it's not so clear that it's a part of the actual exchange. And I think that's what makes it difficult for corporate companies to really like make a large investment into it, because it's so subtle, but it's like literally becoming an overnight expectation.
Yeah. And the textile industry, and you're tightly connected to the textile industry. So that's been an area that's had problems for a really long time, right?
It's the second most like dirtiest industry in the world behind the oil industry. So I guess that's an understatement.
Yeah. So what makes it a dirty industry then?
It's just responsible for the the second most basically environmental pollution damage of any other industry besides the oil industry.
Yeah. And also labor problems, right?
Yeah. Labor is kind of just a very, you know, sort of race to the bottom type scenario, especially as you have like a lot of these commodities that are kind of continue to be held hostage and kind of being subbed out to the lowest bidder, and countries trying to industrialize that want to take those projects on, but at the exploitation of their, you know, workforce. It's a big problem.
Yeah. So workforce exploration, environmental degradation. So how do you run a company that you make sure you're not participating in all that?
I mean, I think that this is Shay. I think the most tangible way to answer that question is you have to have third party accountability. And I think that's what's really stood out to us in this kind of new culture of people wanting a product with a purpose, is it's often very marketing oriented. But if you don't, if you have like something that we believe is like the gold standard B Corp, Patagonia was one of the first B Corp companies in California. We're shortly thereafter. And for anyone that has no idea what B Corp is, it's comparable to LEED certification within architecture, but it's all hinging on environmental and social standards. And we're audited every 2 years, and there's like a passing score of an 80 and a perfect score of a 200. And our score is visible and really transparent for everyone. And it becomes like a great ability for us to really look at the supply chain from a level that's really audited on a much bigger sense of it than just what our kind of integrity means. It's really based off of so much investment on what is fair trade and what really is a holistic idea of doing good. And really this idea that our friend Dan Pallotta, who wrote the book Uncharitable, believes in, is that if you keep on the nonprofit sector for doing good with a lot of these things that are really hinged on an overhead ratio, you'll see change 50 to 100 years from now. But if you really, keyword, responsibly look at free market capitalism, you could see change in 5 to 10 years. Mm. With some of these worldwide epidemics like poverty or labor, in a lot of ways taken advantage of within the garment textile industry.
Yeah, I see in different places you guys talk about advocacy through industry. Is that still a phrase you're using? Is that, and if so, what does that mean for you then?
Yeah, we use it every day. I think it's really key for us, going back to that idea of B Corp. I mean, their whole slogan is using business for good. And our whole kind of metric for people tracking what we're doing is based off of job creation. And so for our example of our market bag, we've produced over 200,000 units of this farmer's market bag, and it allows us to provide a fair trade wage, an annual profit dividend, and a retirement fund for the mothers that handcraft the market bag. And it's really kind of based out of just great leadership on all these different third world supply chains that we work on. And the individual that is the manager of the Market Bag project, he just saw like the fair trade wage is like a great, just kind of low level idea. But he's like, to really break the poverty cycle, let's have an annual profit dividend. And then when these mothers are tired of working, why shouldn't they have a retirement fund? And it still keeps the pricing competitive. It still keeps things in a place of us not having to charge the end customer a lot more than what we believe is a commodity price for a market bag that's got a waterproof lining and it can hold over 120 pounds and it's customizable. But it's, in our opinion, just a simple appreciation for using business for good by creatively looking at how to take care of the whole supply chain.
When you're bringing a new supplier on, how do you do that? How do you find somebody, and then how do you bring them on, and then what's your process around that?
We receive about 1 to 3 artisan opportunities a day at this point, and one out of 100 we actually move forward on, because we've just learned a lot from the Patagonia team. If you're going to look at the rest of the industry as far as comparison, you're probably going to be out of business. And so if you're willing to be really realistic with what you can sustain for a long period of time, specifically if job creation is your metric of success, you have to be all about, Rand and I have no desire of selling the company. We want to do this for the next 40 years and ideally pass it to our kids. And so the whole thought of how you can find people that have everything already intact. So they have to understand logistics. They have to understand quality. They have to understand integrity. They have to understand so many of these things that you often think like, oh, if we're going to go do good, we're going to create all these rules and incentives. And like, that doesn't work at all. Like, the only thing that really works is bringing in someone like my brother that has a great understanding of design, and then bringing it to the market, and then the market just chooses if this is something that can scale, and then really giving them larger and larger orders, that it is kind of what we've seen in Bangladesh, where this group of mothers started in a single story studio that they rented and just recently have bought a six story. Well, they've bought a piece of land and developed a six story studio that is, man, it's over 6,000 square feet, and they're able to pump out like over 10,000 units a month. And it's really done with a level of impacting this community of 200,000. And they're now the largest job creator for garment textile in this northern part of Bangladesh called Saidpur. And it's just like, you look at Rana Plaza a few years ago, and we believe this is kind of like the future of what Bangladesh has as far as potential when you find great leadership and a great product. Like, I think as much as you want the cause and the marketing to be important, like, design is everything. And we believe a sense of reoccurring loyalty is based off of a brand that has a purpose, but 99.9 of our transactions are just based out of good design, or that people saw Gisele Bündchen with our market bag.
Let's get to your story a little bit. I mean, you two guys are brothers. You're doing this business together. And I, you know, first of all, just hats off to you guys for working together as a family. I'm not sure my brothers and I could do this. So congratulations on that. But where, you know, you're building a business, or you're continuing to scale a business that's doing social good. And it kind of feels like you've got the flywheel turning now. So you get 1 to 3 market opportunities a day of suppliers coming in, say, hey, we want to be part of your program. I'm sure that your retail is expanding. I saw you open new spaces. I mean, it's just so much going on with you guys, but that didn't happen yesterday. So first of all, what was kind of the driver behind why you wanted to establish a social good kind of business? And then second of all, how'd you do it? What was your path?
Yeah, I think I can jump in on that.
And this is Ran.
This is Ran, yeah. I think the earliest sort of iteration of what gave us the vision of kind of what has really evolved into like Apollos today was kind of like Shay said, you know, we had a really unique opportunity to travel a lot when we were, you know, kids, children, the sort of vision of our parents that we wouldn't really understand our reality unless we got a better perspective as far as seeing how the rest of the world operated. And it was kind of just led through their involvement in a lot of different nonprofits. And so their investment in sort of our perspective, I think, is really what's developed our vision for this company.
So let me pause you. So your parents traveled with you when you were kids. What was that travel about?
I think both. Yes, and on our own. So they saw travel as the kind of ultimate education of kind of perspective building and real world experience. And, you know, growing up in Southern California, we have like a very warped sense of, you know, identity compared to the rest of the world. It's a very fortunate place to grow up. So I think they knew that we would be, you know, grow up into Southern California monsters if we didn't have that perspective shift. So that was probably a really smart decision. I think like Shay and I grew up in the whole sort of action sports world. And I think, you know, what's interesting about that industry is it's very, to your point, Tony, it talks about this lifestyle, you know, lifestyle brands. And it's sort of this immersion of like every part of your kind of everyday is kind of like centers around these like quote unquote lifestyle brands. But I think for Shay and I, it was so far away from something that really resonated with what our lives like wanted to be about. So I think experiencing different cultures and having this idea of all these differences when we are really confronted with the, you know, majority of similarities, I think it gave us this permission and sort of demystified these cultures where we thought instead of being a spectator as just like a traveler or a tourist, we saw an opportunity to be a participant, you know. And I think the most rich way to experience places or cultures is to actually be like working there and to be part of it. So, and I think the design side, you know, on the social entrepreneurship, social enterprise side, you know, we've seen a lot of things over the last, you know, 10 plus years. And I think primarily you see a lot of social enterprises that have like regional craft manufacturing that are essentially trying to just import these handicrafts like into like a first world economy. And I think what we really envisioned as our point of, you know, value that we could create. A was like trying to scale up a big output market that we're not having to listen to anyone and can just create impact by our purchasing. But B, kind of maybe the most important, was that we saw this huge language barrier between design really being a language and these, you know, different material stories or capacity or capabilities or skill sets. Maybe if they were reinterpreted into some other product execution that could resonate with a kind of global design community, I think that was our greatest value that we could bring to these projects. And so I think, and I would also say that I think product a lot of times starts out neutral. So the fact that we were able to, like, you know, for Shay talked about the market bag, we were able to release it with some of the best, you know, retail stores and publications behind it in, you know, Paris, Tokyo, Hong Kong. And I think all of a sudden this neutral product, we were able to bring momentum to it. And I think that is like what our sweet spot is.
Yeah, I really like what you're saying right now, because I've talked to other people who have style brands, and they were saying, you know, style has to come first. So you get style and quality, and then if impact comes behind that, that's even better, right? But if you aren't getting the style right, then people aren't going to be that interested. It's not really going to represent who they think of themselves as, and that kind of thing. How did you guys develop this, though? I mean, you were probably college students or a little out of college, and so how did you learn all this stuff?
In college, Shay, how did our first department order go?
Well, I mean, Ran was working for a division of Nike for a period of time, and then he and I were always looking at it as like a side project throughout. I mean, I was shipping our first orders when I was in high school and Ran was in college, and then we were shipping department stores from college, and then really full-time once we got out of college and moved to Los Angeles, but didn't really actually turn a profit until 2012. And just being super thankful to a father in the construction business, where all of it was always, you know, sales got to, you know, supersede expenses. So there was never this like idea of, let's just invest in marketing, let's invest in the hope that Oprah is going to wear it and then all our debt's going to go away. You know, let's really be very tactful on brand building with the idea of what we've seen with a couple of our friends, only like a couple, Patagonia and our friends that started the kind of more urban street brand Stussy, is to grow out of profitability and cash flow because you want to do it for a long time. And you see that there's some multi kind of facet purpose on doing it for a long time. And I think people are attracted to that confidence and that posture rather than the idea of like growing really fast and having maybe some blind spots, but that it looks good on the outside.
Yeah. Let me start with you on this question, Shay. So advice to early stage or aspiring social entrepreneurs, what's something you've learned on your journey that you could pass along to early stage social entrepreneurs?
Don't do too much good. Every social entrepreneur, I think they are so fantasized with doing so much good that they're out of business in the first year. They're like, everyone needs health insurance. Everyone needs, and I'm not trying to underplay how important it is to give your team health insurance. But if you can't afford it for the long term because your sales aren't good enough, you're not doing anyone any good. So I think our key kind of things that we're sharing with social entrepreneurs is to really be shrewd about doing good versus being in business for a long period of time. And the second thing is just to surround yourself with people that create an environment that is wanting your, like, that believe more in your sanity than your creativity. Like, I think it's so easy to find people that are just stimulated by you, or you're stimulated by them, but they're not loyal or willing to be, in a sense, like a BS kind of person where they're like, hey, this is a bad idea, you know? To really surround yourself with the type of people that have been an amazing sounding board to allow us to patiently grow and to not get insecure by someone growing faster has been really important to us.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody can grow faster and then die 6 months later. Mm-hmm. So you can't chase that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ran, anything you would add to that?
I would just add, like, you know, I'm kind of like on the actual, like, sort of supply chain kind of A&R, I would say. So I am like, I get to see a lot of different projects and development projects. And I would say that the one thing that I think that I think is kind of a little bit fragile with a lot of these social enterprises is it's, you know, when you're working with these like small cooperatives or social, you know, small supply chains, I think it's so important to really think of how their best interest is kept in mind. I see so many brands that, you know, are starting and they want to have some new purposeful empowerment project, and they'll spin the wheels of the supply chain and get them to sample a bunch of stuff in hopes of a, you know, department store order that never comes. And, you know, I think you get their hopes up, or vice versa, like a single order that never is followed up with any kind of like longevity is almost worse than ever starting. And I think the other side to it is, you know, Shay and I are very apprehensive of actually like going to these projects till we've hit a certain critical mass with them, because I just feel like it's sort of disingenuous to go to one of our projects and spend the travel and spend the marketing dollars and create some media around it before we've ever given them their first purchase order, you know? So yeah. You know, the 15 grand that we could spend in marketing, we should be purchasing like as quickly as possible. So I think just being intuitive to, you know, if you really are doing this for the, you know, the right motives, like just being very sensitive to like these, a lot of these places don't have business experience. They get very excited very quickly to have first world partners. And I think to be, take the lead on how to kind of keep their best interests in mind is like super crucial.
Yeah. If people are looking for Apollis online, where would they look?
APOLISglobal.com.
APOLISglobal.com. Got that. And a call to action. So people have been hanging out with us for the last 25 minutes or so. What's something that you'd like to see them go and do as a result of this conversation?
I'll lead real quick. This is Shay. And I think one of the things that we've come across, we do this speaking series at our flagship store in Soho, New York, as well as in the Arts District of downtown LA, about how different forms of industry impact community in a positive way. And what's really struck us, we've had Marcus Samuelson speak on how food impacts community. We've had Terrell Owens speak on how fitness impacts community. And we've had quite a few others in pretty high levels. And what's really stood out to us is often we make it too difficult. We think that we need to go reinvent the wheel. But if you just look at your immediate skill sets, the things that you like to do, and you just figure out how to tactfully do them with some purpose tomorrow, not like next week, next month, it really gets the ball moving. Because I think often the barrier of entry feels like so hard if we're at a desk and we don't necessarily love what we do, but you might be part of like a little fishing club and you could maybe have some kids come join you for a day and teach them how to fish or whatever it is, to not make it seem so hard to make an impact in your community, specifically with the skill sets that are at your fingertips.
That's great. Well, Shay, Rand, thanks so much for being with us on Social Entrepreneur.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us today. You are the reason that we produce Social Entrepreneur every Monday. You can find the show notes, bonus material, and more at tonyloyd.com. That's TonyLoyd.com. And while you're at it, will you do me a favor? Subscribe, rate, and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. It really helps others to find these stories of changemakers who are making a difference in the world. Well, listen, thanks so much for joining me today. And until next time, please remember to use this one short, amazing life and go make an impact. Thanks. We'll talk to you next time on Social Entrepreneur.